agony in watching her son die, her strength, her love for her children. He talked about the urge for revenge and how Jesus turned the other cheek. He prayed for patience and tolerance and the wisdom of good men to deal with what had happened. He talked about Martin Luther King and his courage in bringing about change by eschewing violence. It's man's nature to strike back, but the second blow leads to the third and the fourth. He thanked his flock for laying down their arms and getting off the streets. Remarkably, it had been a quiet night in Sloan. Canty reminded his people that Dante Drum's name was now famous. It was a symbol that would bring about change.
"Let us not smear it with more blood, more violence."
After a 30-minute warm-up, the worshippers fanned out through the church to pursue the usual Sunday morning activities. A mile away, members of the First Baptist Church began arriving for a unique worship experience. The rubble of their sanctuary was still lined with yellow police tape, still a crime scene under active investigation. In a parking lot, a large white tent had been erected. Beneath it were rows of folding chairs and tables covered with food. The dress was casual, the mood generally upbeat. After a quick breakfast, they sang hymns, old-time gospel tunes with a beat and lyrics they knew by heart. The chairman of the deacons spoke about the fire and, more important, about the new church they would build. They had insurance, they had faith, they would borrow if necessary, but a beautiful new sanctuary would rise from the ashes, all to the glory of the Lord. Reva was not in attendance. She had not come out of the house. Frankly, she was hardly missed. Her friends felt her pain, now that her daughter had been found. But with Reva, the pain had been relentless for 9 years. Her friends could not help but remember the vigils by the Red River, the marathon prayer sessions, the endless tirades in the press, the enthusiastic embrace of victimhood, all in an effort to extract revenge on that monster, Dante Drum. Now that they had executed the wrong monster, and with Reva happily watching him die, few of her fellow church members wanted to face her. Fortunately, she did not want to face them. Brother Ronnie was a troubled soul. He had watched his church burn, which was no fault of his, but he had also watched Dante die, and with no small measure of satisfaction. There was a sin in there somewhere. He was a Baptist, a breed noted for its creative ways of finding new versions of sin, and he needed forgiveness. He shared this with his congregation. He bared his soul, admitted he was wrong, and asked them to pray for him. He seemed genuinely humbled and distressed. Arrangements for Nicole's funeral were incomplete. Brother Ronnie explained that he had talked with Reva by phone. She was not taking visitors, and the church website would post the details when the family made decisions. Nicole was still in Missouri, and the authorities there had not said when they would release her. The tent was being watched closely. Across the street, on property that did not belong to the church, 2 dozen or so reporters loitered about, most with cameras. If not for the presence of several quite edgy police officers, the reporters would have been under the tent, recording every word, making a nuisance of themselves. Sloan had never been more divided than on that Sunday morning, but even at that dark hour there was some circling of the wagons. The number of reporters and cameras had steadily increased since Thursday, and everyone in town felt an element of the siege. The man on the street had stopped talking to reporters. City officials had nothing but no comment. Not a single word could be pried out of the courthouse. And in certain places, the police increased their presence and sharpened their attitude. Any reporter trying to get near the Drum home was likely to be handled roughly. The funeral home where Dante was resting was strictly off limits. Reva's house was being guarded by cousins and friends, but the police were nearby just waiting for some clown with a camera to intrude. Robbie Flack could take care of himself and was doing a fine job of it, but his home and office were patrolled every hour. And on Sunday morning, the devoted Christians who worshipped at the Bethel African Methodist Church and at the First Baptist Church were able to do so without intrusion. The Sloan Police Department made sure of it. At St. Mark's Lutheran, the Reverend Keith Schroeder assumed the pulpit and startled his congregation with the most gripping opening of any sermon yet. Last Thursday, the state of Texas executed an innocent man. If you've missed the story, then I don't know where you've been. Most of you know the facts of the case, but what you don't know is that the real killer was here last Sunday, sitting right over there. His name is Travis Boyette, a convicted felon, released a few weeks ago from the prison in Lansing and assigned to a halfway house on 17th Street, here in Topeka. No one in the crowd of 200 seemed to be breathing. Those who had been planning naps were suddenly wide awake. Keith was amused at the odd looks he was getting. He went on. No, I'm not kidding. And while I would like to say that Mr. Boyette was attracted to our little church because of its reputation for great preaching, the truth is that he came because he was troubled. First thing Monday morning, he was in my study to talk about his problems. He then made his way down to Texas and tried to stop the execution of Dante Drum. He was unsuccessful. Somehow, he got away. Keith's initial plan was to describe his adventures in Texas in what would undoubtedly be his most fascinating sermon ever. He was not afraid of the truth. He wanted it told. He assumed his church would find out sooner or later, and he was determined to confront the issue head on. However, Dana had maintained that the wiser course was to wait until he met with a lawyer. Admitting to a crime, especially in such a public manner, without the advice of counsel, seemed risky. She prevailed, and Keith decided on a different message. As a minister, he steadfastly refused to mix politics and religion. In the pulpit, he had stayed away from issues such as gay rights, abortion, and war, preferring instead to teach what Jesus taught. Love your neighbor. Help the less fortunate. Forgive others because you have been forgiven. And follow God's laws. However, after witnessing the execution, Keith was a different person, or at least a different preacher. Suddenly, confronting social injustice was far more important than making his flock feel good each Sunday. He would begin hitting the issues, always from the Christian perspective and never from the politicians. And if it rankled folks, too bad. He was tired of playing it safe. Would Jesus witness an execution without trying to stop it? He asked. Would Jesus approve of laws that allow us to kill those who have killed? The answer to both was no. And for a full hour, in the longest sermon of his career, Keith explained why not. Before dark on Sunday afternoon, Roberta Drum, with her three children, their spouses, and her five grandchildren, walked a few blocks to Washington Park. They had made the same walk the day before, and for the same purpose. They met with the young people congregated there, and in one-on-one conversations talked about Dante's death and what it was doing to all of them. The rap was turned off. The crowd became quiet and respectful. At one point, several dozen gathered around Roberta and listened as she pleaded for civility. In a strong, eloquent voice, and sometimes pointing for emphasis, she said, "Please don't desecrate the memory of my son with more bloodshed. I don't want the name of Dante Drum to be remembered as the reason for a race riot here in Sloan. Nothing you do out here on the streets will help our people. Violence creates more violence, and in the end we lose. Please, go home and hug your mother." To his people, Dante Drum was already a legend. The courage of his mother inspired them to go home. Chapter 37. Sloan High School did not open Monday morning. Though the tension appeared to be easing, the school authorities and the police were still nervous. Another round of fights and smoke bombs could spill over into the streets and disrupt the fragile truce. The white students were ready to return to class, to their normal routines and activities. As a rule, they were shocked, even appalled by what had happened over the weekend. They were as stunned by the drum execution as their black friends, and they were anxious to confront it, discuss it, and try to move on. The joining of the sit-in by the white football players at the Longview game was the topic of non-stop chatter around town, and that simple act of solidarity was viewed as one huge offer of an apology. A momentous mistake had been made, but others were to blame. Let's meet and shake hands and deal with it. For most of the black students, the thought of continued violence was not appealing. They had the same routines and activities as their white friends, and they, too, wanted to return to normalcy. The school board met again with the mayor and the police. The term powder keg was used often to describe the atmosphere in Sloan. There were enough hotheads on both sides to make trouble. Anonymous phone calls were still being recorded. There were threats of violence as soon as the school reopened. In the end, it was decided that the safest route was to wait until after the funeral of Dante Drum. At 9 a.m., the football team met with their coaches in the locker room at the field. The meeting was closed. The 28 black players were there, as were their white teammates, all 41 of them. The meeting had been suggested by Cedric and Marvin Drum, both of whom had played as warriors, though at a level far below their brothers. Standing side by side, they addressed the team. They thanked the white players for their courage in joining the Longview players in protest. They spoke fondly, even emotionally, of their brother and said that Dante would not approve of the divisiveness. The football team was the pride of the town, and if it managed to heal itself, then there was hope for everyone. They appealed for unity. Cedric said, "When we bury Dante, I ask that all of you be there. It will mean so much to our family and to the rest of the community." Denny Weeks, the son of a Sloan policeman and the first player to remove his helmet and jersey and sit with the Longview players, asked if he could speak. He faced the team and began by describing how sickened he was by the execution and its aftermath. He, along with most of the whites he knew, had felt all along that Dante was guilty and getting what he deserved. He was wrong, so incredibly wrong, and he would always carry the guilt. He apologized for what he'd believed, that he'd favored the execution. Denny became emotional, and trying to keep his composure, finished by saying that he hoped Cedric and Marvin, the rest of the family, and his black teammates could find it in their hearts to forgive him. Other confessionals followed, and the meeting became a prolonged and fruitful effort at reconciliation. It was a team, complete with petty grudges and fierce rivalries, but most of the boys had played football together since middle school and knew each other well. They had nothing to gain by allowing the bitterness to fester. The state officials were still trying to resolve the baffling issues presented by the Longview standoff. It was generally believed that both teams would be given a forfeit, but the regular season would go on. There was one game left on the schedule. The coach said that it was all or nothing. If they could not come together as a team, then the last game would be forfeited. With Cedric and Marvin standing before them, the players had no choice. They could not say no to the brothers of Dante Drum. After 2 hours, they shook hands and decided to meet that afternoon for a long practice. The spirit of reconciliation had not reached the Flack Law Firm, and it probably would not. Energized by a quiet Sunday and facing a mountain of work, Robbie pushed the troops to prepare for an assault on various fronts. Top priority was the civil litigation. Robbie was determined to file suit that day, both in state and in federal court. The state action, for wrongful death, would be a shotgun blast aimed at the city of Sloan, its police department, the county and its district attorney, the state and its judges, prison officials, and appeals court justices. The members of the judiciary were immune from liability, but Robbie planned to sue them anyway. He would sue the governor, who was absolutely immune. Much of the lawsuit would be dismantled and eventually dismissed, but Robbie didn't care. He wanted revenge, and embarrassing those responsible and forcing them to hire lawyers were things he relished. He loved bare-knuckle litigation, especially when he was throwing the punches and the press was watching. His clients, the Drums, were sincerely opposed to more violence in the streets, as was Robbie, but he knew how to create violence in the courts. The litigation would drag on for years and consume him, but he was confident of prevailing eventually. The lawsuit in federal court would be a civil rights action with many of the same defendants. There, he would not waste time suing the judges, justices, and the governor, but would hit hard at the city of Sloan, its police, and Paul Coffey. In light of what had become obvious, he foresaw a lucrative settlement, but far down the road. The city and county, and more important, their insurance companies, would never run the risk of having their dirty laundry aired before a jury in such a notorious case. When they were fully exposed, the actions of Drew Kerber and Paul Coffey would terrify the well-paid lawyers for the insurers. Robbie was obsessed with revenge, but he also smelled money. Other strategies on the table included an ethics complaint against Paul Coffey. A win there could mean disbarment and further humiliation, though Robbie was not overly optimistic. He also made plans to file a complaint against Chief Justice Milton Prudlow with the State Commission on Judicial Conduct. But this would take more time. So few of the facts surrounding the aborted filing were known. It appeared, though, as if the facts would be forthcoming. Something akin to a hornet's nest of reporters was already attacking the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. Robbie was content to sit back and watch the press flush out the truth. He contacted the Justice Department in Washington. He took calls from death penalty opponents around the country. He chatted with reporters. His office was chaos, and he thrived on it. The law office Keith and Dana walked into Monday morning was far different from the last one Keith had seen. The Flack law firm had been filled with people, tension, and activity. The office of Elmo Laird was small and quiet. Matthew's scouting report described Elmo as a sole practitioner, a 60-year-old veteran of the criminal courts who dispensed solid advice but rarely went to trial. He and Matthew were friends, and more important, Elmo played golf with the district attorney. "I've never had a case like this," Elmo admitted after listening to Keith for a few minutes. He had done his homework and, like everyone who enjoys the morning paper, knew the basics of the Drum mess down in Texas. "Well, it's something new for me, too," Keith said. "There's no clear statute on point. You provided assistance to a man who was determined to violate his parole anyway by leaving this jurisdiction. It's not exactly a major crime, but you could be prosecuted for obstruction of justice."
"We've read the statutes," Dana said. "Matthew sent them over along with a few cases from other states. Nothing is clear."
"I haven't been able to find a similar case in Kansas," Elmo said. "Not that that means anything. If the district attorney chooses to prosecute, then I'd say he has a pretty good case."
"You're admitting everything, aren't you?"
"Sure," Keith said. "Then I suggest we explore the possibility of a plea agreement, and sooner the better." "Boyette is on the loose. He may strike again, maybe not. Perhaps this week, maybe never. It's to your advantage to cut a deal, a good deal, before he makes any more trouble. If he hurts someone, you become more culpable, and a simple case could get complicated."
"What's a good deal?" Keith asked.
"No jail and a slap on the wrist," Elmo said with a shrug.
"And what does that mean?"
"Not much. A quick court appearance, a small fine of some sort, certainly no time in jail."
"I was hoping you'd say that," Dana said.
"And after some time, I could probably get your record expunged," Elmo added.
"But the conviction would be a public record, right?" Keith asked.
"Yes, and that is worrisome. Boyette was front-page news this morning here in Topeka, and I suspect there will be more about him in the coming days. It's our own little connection to this sensational episode. If a reporter sniffs around, he might stumble across your conviction. It's a pretty good story, if you think about it. Local minister gives assistance to the real killer, and so on.
I can see a big splash in the paper, but no permanent damage. The bigger story will be written if and when he commits another crime. Then the prosecutor will take some heat and might be harder to deal with. Keith and Dana exchanged uncertain looks. It was their first visit to a law office together, and hopefully their last. Keith said, "Look, Mr. Laird, I really don't want this hanging over my head. I'm guilty of doing what I did. If I committed a crime, I'll take my punishment. Our question is simple. What now?"
"Give me a few hours to talk to the district attorney. If he agrees, then we cut a quick deal and get it over with. With some luck, you'll slide under the radar."
"How soon could this happen?"
Another shrug. "This week?"
"And you promise he's not going to jail?" Dana asked, almost pleading.
"No promises, but it's very unlikely. Let's talk first thing in the morning."
Keith and Dana sat in the car outside Laird's office and stared at the side of his building. "I can't believe we're here, doing this, talking about pleading guilty, worrying about going to jail," she said.
"Isn't it great? I love it."
"You what?"
"I gotta tell you, Dana, other than our honeymoon, this past week has been the greatest week of my life."
"You're sick. You've spent too much time with Boyette."
"I sort of miss Travis."
"Drive, Keith. You're cracking up." The governor was officially hard at work grappling with the state's budget. He was too busy to comment on the drum matter. The case was closed, as far as he was concerned. Unofficially, he was locked in his office with Wayne and Barry, all three dazed and hungover, eating ibuprofen and bitching about what to do next. Reporters were camped outside the building. They'd actually filmed him as he left the governor's mansion that morning at 7:30 with his security detail, something he did 5 days a week, as if such a movement were now breaking news. The office was being flooded with calls, faxes, emails, letters, people, even packages. Barry said, "It's a shitstorm, growing worse by the minute. 31 editorials yesterday, coast to coast, another 17 today. At this rate, every newspaper in the country will take a shot. Nonstop yakking on cable, experts popping up by the dozens with advice on what to do next."
"And what should we do next?" the governor asked.
"Moratoriums, moratoriums. Give up capital punishment, or at least study it to death."
"Polls?"
"The polls say we screwed up, but it's too early for something like this. Give it a few days. Let the aftershocks die down, then we'll ease back into the market. I suspect we'll lose a few points, but my guess is at least 65% are still in favor of the needle."
"Wayne?"
Wayne was buried in his laptop, but not missing a word.
69, still my favorite number."
"I'll split it," the governor said. 67, all in?" Barry and Wayne gave a quick thumbs up. The standard polling bet was now in play. Each of the three with $100 on the line. The governor walked to his favorite window for the 100th time, but saw nothing outside.
"I gotta talk to someone. Staying in here and ignoring the press makes me look like I'm hiding."
"You are so hiding," Barry said. "Find me an interview with someone we can trust."
"There's always Fox. I talked to Chuck Monahan 2 hours ago, and he would love to have a chat. He's harmless, and his numbers are way up."
"Will he give us the questions ahead of time?"
"Of course he will. He'll do anything."
"I like it. Wayne?"
Wayne cracked his knuckles with enough force to break them, then said,
"Not so fast. What's the urgency? Sure, you're hunkered down, but give it some time. Let's think of where we'll be a week from now."
"My guess is it will be right here," Barry said, "with the door locked, pulling our hair out and trying to decide what to do next."
"But it's such a big moment," the governor said. "I hate to let it pass."
"Let it pass," Wayne said. "You look bad right now, Gov, and there's no way to fix that. What we need is time, and lots of it. I say we lay low, dodge the bullets, let the press chew on coffee and the cops and the Court of Appeals. Let a month go by. It won't be pleasant, but the clock will not stop."
"I say we go to Fox," Barry said.
"And I say we don't," Wayne shot back. "I say we cook up a trade mission to China and leave for 10 days.
explore foreign markets, more outlets for Texas products, more jobs for our people.
I did that 3 months ago, Newton said. I hate Chinese food.
You look weak, Barry said.
Running away smack in the middle of the biggest story since that last hurricane? Bad idea.
I agree. I'm not leaving.
Then can I go to China? Wayne asked.
No.
What time is it?
The governor wore a watch, and there were at least 3 clocks in his office. When that question was asked late in the afternoon, it meant only one thing. Barry stepped to the cabinet and pulled out a bottle of Knob Creek bourbon. The governor sat behind his massive desk and took a sip.
When is the next execution? He asked Wayne.
His lawyer punched keys, stared at his laptop, and said,
16 days.
Barry said,
Oh, boy.
Who is it? Newton asked.
Wayne said, Drifty Tucker. Male, white, 51 years old, Panola County. Killed his wife when he caught her in bed with the next-door neighbor. Shot the neighbor, too, 8 times. Had to reload.
Is that a crime? Barry asked.
Not in my book, Newton said.
No claim of innocence?
Nope. He claimed insanity, but it looks as if the reloading bit nailed him.
Can we get a court somewhere to issue a stay? Newton asked.
I'd rather not deal with it.
I'll work on it. The governor took another sip, shook his head, and mumbled,
Just what we need right now, another execution.
Wayne suddenly reacted as if he'd been slapped.
Get a load of this. Robbie Flack just filed a lawsuit in state court in Chester County, naming a bunch of defendants. One of them is the Honorable Gil Newton, governor. $50 million in damages for the wrongful death of Dante Drum.
He can't do that, the governor said.
He just did. Looks like he emailed a copy of it to all defendants, as well as to every newspaper in the state.
I'm immune.
Of course you are, but you've been sued anyway.
Barry sat down and began scratching his hair. The governor closed his eyes and mumbled to himself. Wayne gawked at his laptop, mouth wide open. A bad day just took a turn for the worse. Chapter 38. Keith sat in his office at the church, hands locked behind his head, shoeless feet on the desk, eyes gazing at the ceiling. His thoughts still scrambled after all of it. Once or twice in the past few days, his mind had returned to family and church matters. But those pleasant diversions were always ruined when he thought of Travis Boyette loose on the streets. He had reminded himself countless times that he did not help Boyette escape. The man was already roaming the streets of Topeka, a convict who'd served his time and was lawfully re-entering society. He, Boyette, had made the decision to leave Anchor House and violate his parole before he convinced Keith to become his chauffeur. But Keith was living with a knot in his stomach, a constant nag that assured him he had done something wrong. To take a break from Boyette, he yanked his feet off the desk and turned to face his computer. The monitor was showing a website for the Kansas chapter of AADP, Americans Against the Death Penalty, and Keith decided to join. Using his credit card, he paid the $25 annual fee, now one of 3,000 members and as such entitled to the online newsletter, a monthly magazine with all the latest and other periodic updates from the staff. The group met once a year in Wichita, details to follow. Outside of the church, it was the first organization he'd ever joined. Out of curiosity, he looked at the sites of anti-death penalty groups in Texas and found plenty. He noticed the names of several groups he'd seen in the news coverage the past 2 days. The abolitionists down there were making the most of the Drum execution, and there was no shortage of activity. Execution Watch, Students Against the Death Penalty, Texas Network Moratorium, Talk, Texans Against Legalized Killing, Texans for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. One familiar name was Death Penalty Focus. Keith went to its website and was impressed. Membership was only $10. Keith pulled out his credit card and signed up. He was enjoying himself and not thinking about Boyette. The largest and oldest group in Texas was ATEX, an acronym for Abolish Texas Executions. It not only published extensively on the subject of capital punishment, but also pushed its policies on the legislature, built support groups for the men and women on death row, raised money to defend those charged with capital crimes, networked with dozens of other groups around the country, and, most impressively, at least in Keith's opinion, reached out to both families, those of the victims and those of the condemned. ATEX had 15,000 members and an annual budget of $2 million and offered membership to anyone willing to pay $25. Keith was in the mood, and moments later he joined his third group. $60 later, he felt like a certified abolitionist. His intercom beeped and broke the silence. Charlotte Younger announced, "There's a reporter on the phone. I think you should talk to her." "Where's she from?" "Houston, and she's not going away."
"Thanks." He answered the phone.
"This is the Reverend Keith Schroeder." "Reverend Schroeder, my name is Eliza Keene. I'm with the Houston Chronicle." Her voice was soft, her words unhurried, her accent similar to the twang Keith had heard in Sloan. "I have some questions about Travis Boyette." His life flashed before his eyes. Headlines, controversy, handcuffs, jail. Keith froze long enough to convince Ms. Keene that she was on the right trail. "Sure," he said. What was he supposed to say? He would not lie and deny knowing Boyette. For a split second, he thought about refusing to talk to her, but that would set off alarms. "Do you mind if I record our conversation?" she asked pleasantly. Yes, no, he had no idea. "Well, no," he said. "Good. It helps me keep things accurate. Just a second." A pause. "Now the recorder is on." "Okay," Keith said, but only because it seemed as though something was needed on his end. He decided to stall as he tried to gather his thoughts. "Say, Miss Keene, I don't spend a lot of time talking to reporters. Is there some way I can verify that you are indeed a reporter for the Houston Chronicle?" "Is your computer on?" "It is." "Then I'm sending you my bio right now. I'm also sending a photo taken outside the law office of Robbie Flack. It was last Thursday as Mr. Flack and his team were leaving. There are four people in the photo, one wearing a dark jacket and a white collar. I'll bet that's you." Keith opened the email, checked the attachment. It was him. He scanned her bio but knew it wasn't necessary. "Nice looking guy," Keith said. "We thought so. That you?"
"Yep."
"Did you witness the execution of Dante Drum?" she asked, and Keith's mouth went dry. He grunted, cleared his throat, and said, "Why do you think I witnessed the execution?" "We have obtained the records from the prison. You're listed as a witness for the inmate. Plus one of them standing behind you during the execution was a reporter, not for us, but for another paper. He did not get your name. I found it." What would Elmo Laird advise him to do at this point? Stop talking, perhaps. He wasn't sure, but he was impressed. If she had the prison records and a photo, then what else had she found? His curiosity took over. "Then I guess I witnessed the execution," he said. "Why would a Lutheran minister from Topeka witness an execution in Texas?" she asked. It was the same question Keith had posed to himself at least 1,000 times. Keith forced a chuckle and said, "It's a long story." "A friend of Dante Drum's?" "No. Travis Boyette was staying at a halfway house in Topeka. Then he pops up in Sloan, Texas. Any idea how he got there?" "Perhaps." "Do you drive a maroon Subaru, Kansas plates, registration LLZ 787? I'm assuming you have a copy of my registration. I do, and one of our reporters noticed the car in Sloan. Not many Kansans stop over in Sloan. Any chance Boyette hitched a ride with you?
Another chuckle. This one for real. All right, Miss Keene. What do you want from me?
I want the story, Reverend Schroeder. All of it.
That would take hours, and I'm not willing to spend the time, not right now.
When did you first meet Travis Boyette?
1 week ago today, last Monday.
And at that time, did he admit to the murder of Nicole Yarber?
Surely all confidentiality was gone. Boyette had broadcast his admissions to the world. There weren't too many secrets left. Some things, though, should be kept private.
Keith wasn't obliged to answer the question, or any others for that matter. He was not afraid of the truth. In fact, he was determined not to hide it. If his tracks were this easy to follow, other reporters would be calling soon.
Let's get it over with.
This is what I'm willing to say, Ms. Keene. Travis Boyette visited our church Sunday of last week. He wanted to talk, so he came back the following day. He confided in me, and we eventually made our way down to Sloan, Texas, arriving last Thursday around midday. He was determined to stop the execution because Dante Drum was innocent. Boyette went on the air, admitted that he was the killer, and gave the statement that we've all seen. Mr. Flack asked me to travel with him to Huntsville. I reluctantly said yes, and one thing led to another. I met Dante, and quite unexpectedly witnessed the execution. The following morning, Boyette led Mr. Flack and others, including me, to the place in Missouri where he'd buried the girl. After that, Boyette fell ill. I took him to a hospital in Joplin, and from there he managed to walk away. I drove home. I've had no contact with Boyette since. There was a pause on the other end as she digested this.
Reverend Schroeder, I have about 1,000 questions.
And I'm late for soccer practice. Good day, ma'am.
Keith hung up and hurriedly left the office. Fordyce, Hitting Hard, ran a 1-hour segment during primetime Monday night. The event had been shamelessly advertised throughout the weekend, and Sean Fordyce spoke to the world live from Sloan, Texas, where he was still darting around in search of another fire or, hopefully, a dead body or a bomb blast. The first half hour was the Riva show, with lots of tears and anticipation of the execution. There was footage of Nicole as a little girl dancing in a recital, and more of her bounding on the sideline as she cheered on the Warriors. There was a clip of Dante mauling a running back, and lots of Riva, with the highlight being the post-execution interview. In light of the obvious, she looked foolish, almost pathetic, and it was obvious Fordyce set her up for the kill. There were close shots of Riva bawling without restraint, then going mute as she watched the tape of Boyette for the first time. She was visibly shaken when Boyette displayed Nicole's class ring. After that, no more Riva. In the second half, Fordyce ran a collage of videos and interviews and produced nothing that wasn't already known. The piece was a mess. It was ironic that a mouthpiece so enamored of the death penalty was airing an exclusive about a wrongful execution. But irony was lost on Sean Fordyce. He cared for nothing but ratings. Keith and Dana watched it. During his chaotic hours in Sloan and the frenzy to actually get there, he had seen nothing of Nicole's family. He'd read about Riva online but had not heard her speak. At least the Fordyce piece was good for something. Not having dealt with Riva, he could easily feel sorry for her. There was a phone call he had been delaying for several hours. As Dana prepped the boys for bed, Keith retreated to the bedroom and called Elmo Laird. He apologized for disturbing him at home, but things were changing rapidly and Keith deemed the call important. Elmo said not to worry. After Keith explained in detail the conversation with Eliza Keene, Elmo suggested that perhaps they should worry.
Probably not a good idea, was his first response.
But she had the story, Mr. Laird, the facts, the paperwork, the photo. She knew everything. I would have sounded stupid trying to deny things. You're not required to speak to reporters, you know.
I know, but I'm not running from anyone. I did what I did. The truth is on the table.
I appreciate that, Pastor, but you hired me to give advice. There would have been a better time and place to tell your story, a setting of our choosing.
I'm sorry. I don't understand legalities. Right now, I'm overwhelmed with the law and its endless procedures.
Of course, my clients usually are. That's why they hire me.
So I screwed up.
Not necessarily, but get ready for all hell to break loose. Pardon my language, Pastor. I expect coverage of this. I'm not sure the drum story can take any more ink, but your story will certainly be a new wrinkle.
I'm confused, Mr. Laird. Help me here. How will the coverage affect my case?
Keith, come on. You really don't have a case. There are no charges pending, and there may never be. I spoke with the district attorney this afternoon. He and I are friends. And while he was captivated with your story, he wasn't gung-ho to crank up a prosecution. He didn't rule it out, and again, I'm afraid Boyette is the key. He's probably the most famous convict on the loose right now. He was indicted for murder in Missouri today. Did you see?
I saw it a couple of hours ago, Keith said.
His face is everywhere, so maybe he'll be caught. I doubt if he comes back to Kansas. Let Missouri have him. If he's locked up before he hurts someone, I think the DA here might close the book.
And the publicity about my involvement?
We'll see. A lot of people around here will admire you for what you did. I can't see much room to criticize you for trying to save Dante Drum, especially in light of what we know now. We'll ride it out, but please, no more interviews.
You got it, Mr. Laird.
Chapter 39. Keith slept off and on for 4 hours, then finally got out of bed and went to the kitchen. He checked CNN, saw nothing new, then opened his laptop and checked in with Houston. On cron.com, there were several stories with Robbie and his lawsuits getting the lead. There was a photo of him waving some papers on the steps of the Chester County Courthouse. He was quoted at length, with predictable statements about hounding those responsible for the wrongful death of Dante Drum to their graves. None of the defendants, including the governor, commented. The next story was about the reactions of the various anti-death penalty groups in the state, and Keith was proud to see ATEX taking the lead. There were demands for a number of drastic responses. The usual moratorium on executions, investigations of the Sloan Police Department, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, the governor's handling of clemency, the trial itself, Paul Coffey and his office, and on and on. Demonstrations were planned for noon Tuesday at the state capitol in Austin, Sam Houston State University in Huntsville, Texas Southern University, and a dozen other schools. The longest-serving member of the Texas Senate was a feisty black attorney from Houston, Roger Ebbs, and he had a lot to say. He was demanding that the governor call an emergency session of the legislature so that a special inquiry could be initiated to investigate all aspects of the Drum fiasco. Ebbs was vice chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and thus had considerable influence over every aspect of the state's budget. He promised to shut down the state government if a special session did not take place. No comment from the governor. Drifty Tucker, the next man scheduled to be executed, was suddenly in the news. His date was November 28th, a little over 2 weeks away, and his case, dormant for a decade, was attracting a lot of attention. Eliza Keene's article was number 4 on the list. Keith clicked on it and saw the photo of himself, Robbie, Aaron, and Martha Handler, all looking quite serious as they left the train station for the trip to Huntsville. The headline was, "Kansas Minister Witnessed Drum Execution." She covered the basics of the story and attributed several quotes to Keith. She, too, had witnessed an execution years earlier and was intrigued by how someone could be approved as a witness on such short notice. No one from the prison would comment. Evidently, she had contacted the Flack law firm for a word or two, but found no one willing to talk.
A counselor at Anchor House said that Reverend Schroeder had stopped by at least twice the previous week looking for Boyette. He had signed the register. Boyette's parole officer was mum. About half the article dealt with Keith and Boyette in their mad rush to Texas to stop the execution. There was a smaller photo of Boyette taken when he addressed the reporters the previous Thursday. The second half of the report took a different turn and dwelled on Keith's potential legal problems. Could the minister be prosecuted for knowingly aiding a felon in his flight to violate parole? To get to the bottom of this, Miss Keene called upon some experts. A law professor at the University of Houston was quoted, "It was an honorable thing to do, but a clear violation of the law. Now that Boyette is at large, I suspect the minister might want to consult with a lawyer." "Thanks, loudmouth," Keith said to himself. "And the violation is anything but clear, according to my lawyer. Perhaps you should do a bit of research before popping off in the press." A criminal defense lawyer in Houston said, "There may be a violation, but looking at the whole picture, I think the guy is a hero. I would love to defend him before a jury." A jury? Elmo Laird was hoping for a quick, quiet little guilty plea with a slap on the wrist. That's what Keith remembered anyway. And to cover all angles, Ms. Keene chatted with a former Texas prosecutor who was quoted as saying, "A crime is a crime, regardless of the circumstances. I would cut him no slack. The fact that he's a minister is of no significance." The fifth article was a continuation of the ferocious investigation into what happened in the governor's office in the waning hours before the execution. So far, the team of journalists had been unable to smoke out anyone from inside the governor's office who would admit to having seen the video of Boyette making his confession. The email was sent from the Flack Law Firm at 3:11 p.m., and Robbie certainly made his server records available. The governor's office did not. Nothing was forthcoming. His close aides, and dozens who were not so close, were marching in step and saying nothing. This would probably change. When the investigations began and the subpoenas started flying, the finger-pointing would begin. At 6:02 a.m., the phone rang. Caller ID showed it as unknown. Keith grabbed it before it woke up Dana and the boys. A man with a thick accent, possibly French, said he was looking for Reverend Keith Schroeder. "And who are you?"
"My name is Antoine Didier. I'm with Le Monde, a newspaper in Paris. I would like to speak about the drum matter."
"I'm sorry, I have no comment." Keith hung up and waited for it to ring again. It did. He grabbed it, gave an abrupt, "No comment, sir," then hung up again. There were four phones in the house, and he hurried through and punched "Do not disturb" on all of them. In the bedroom, Dana was coming to life.
"Who is calling?" she asked, rubbing her eyes.
"The French."
"The who?"
"Get up. It might be a long day." Lazarus Flint was the first black park ranger in East Texas. For over 30 years, he had supervised the maintenance of Rush Point along the Red River, and for the past 9 years, he and his two staff members had patiently cared for the sacred ground upon which the family and friends of Nicole Yarber made their treks and conducted their vigils. He had watched them for years. They showed up every now and then, and they would sit at the point near the makeshift cross. They would sit and cry and burn candles, all the while gazing into the river in the distance, as if the river had taken her away. As if they knew for certain that was her final resting place. And once a year, on the anniversary of her disappearance, her mother made her annual pilgrimage to Rush Point, always with cameras around her, always wailing and carrying on. They burned more candles, packed flowers around the cross, brought mementos and crude artwork and signs with messages. They would stay until dark and always left with a prayer at the cross. Lazarus was from Sloan, and he had never believed Dante was guilty. One of his nephews was sent away for a burglary he had nothing to do with, and Lazarus, like most blacks in Sloan, had never trusted the police. "They got the wrong man," he'd said many times from a distance as he watched Nicole's family and friends carry on. Early Tuesday, long before anyone arrived at Rush Point. Lazarus parked his pickup truck near the shrine and slowly, methodically began dismantling the junk. He yanked the cross from the ground. There had been several crosses over the years, each larger than the last. He lifted the wax-covered block of granite upon which they stuck the candles. There were four photos of Nicole, two laminated and two framed in glass. A very pretty girl, Lazarus thought as he placed the photos in his truck. A terrible death, but then so was Dante's. He gathered tiny porcelain figures of cheerleaders, clay tablets with printed messages, bronze works with no discernible meanings, baffling works of oil on canvas and bunches of wilted flowers. It was a load of trash, in his opinion. What a waste, Lazarus said to himself as he drove away. Wasted effort, time, tears, emotions, hatred, hope, prayers. The girl had been more than 5 hours away, buried in the hills of Missouri by someone else. She had never been near Rush Point. Paul Coffey entered the chambers of Judge Henry on Tuesday at 12:15. Though it was lunchtime, there was no food in sight. Judge Henry stayed behind his desk, and Coffey sat in a deep leather chair, one he knew well. Coffey had not left his cabin since Friday night. On Monday, he had not called his office, and his staff knew nothing of his whereabouts. His two court appearances, both in front of Judge Henry, had been postponed. He looked gaunt, tired, pale, with even deeper circles under his eyes. His customary prosecutor's swagger had vanished.
"How are you doing these days, Paul?" the judge began pleasantly.
"I've been better."
"I'm sure you have. Are you and your staff still working on the theory that Drum and Boyette were in cahoots?"
"We're giving that some thought," Coffey said while staring out a window to his left. Eye contact was difficult for Coffey, but not for Judge Henry.
"Perhaps I can help here, Paul. You and I, and the rest of the world at this moment, know full well that such a ridiculous theory is nothing but a sick, lame, desperate attempt to save your ass. Paul, listen to me. Your ass cannot be saved. Nothing can save you. And if you trot out this co-defendant theory, you will be laughed out of town. Worse, it will only create more tension. It's not going to fly, Paul. Don't pursue it. Don't file anything, because if you do, I'll dismiss it immediately. Forget about everything in your office right now."
"Are you telling me to quit?"
"Yes. Immediately. Your career will end in disgrace. Get it over with, Paul. Until you step down, the blacks will be in the streets."
"Suppose I don't want to resign?"
"I can't make you, but I can make you wish you had. I'm your judge, Paul. I rule on every motion in every case. I preside over every trial. As long as you are the district attorney, your office gets nothing out of me. Don't even file a motion because I won't consider it. Don't indict anyone. I'll quash the indictments. Don't ask for a trial because I'm busy that week. Nothing, Paul. Nothing. You and your staff will be able to do nothing."
Coffey was breathing through his mouth, frowning at the judge, trying to digest what he'd just heard.
"That's pretty severe, Judge."
"If that's what it takes to get you out of office."
"I could file a complaint."
Judge Henry laughed.
"I'm 81 years old and retiring."
"I don't care."
Coffey slowly got to his feet and walked to a window. He spoke with his back to the judge.
"I don't care either, Elias, to be honest. I just want to get out of here, take a break, run away. I'm only 56, still young enough to do something else."
A long pause as Coffey rubbed a pane of glass with a finger.
"God, I can't believe this, Judge. How did this happen?"
"Everybody got careless. Bad police work. When there's no evidence, the easiest way to solve a crime is to get a confession.
Coffee turned around and took a few steps to the edge of the desk. His eyes were moist. His hands trembled.
I can't lie, Judge. I feel rotten.
I understand. I'm sure I would, too, under the circumstances.
Coffee stared at his feet for a long time. Finally, he said,
I'll quit, Elias, if that's what it takes.
I guess that means a special election.
Eventually. But I have a suggestion. When you resign, put Grimshaw in charge. He's the best of your assistants. Call in the grand jury and indict Boyette for the crime. The faster the better. It's a wonderfully symbolic act. We, the judicial system, in effect admit our mistake, and we are now trying to rectify it by prosecuting the real killer. Our admission will do much to soothe feelings in Sloan. Coffee nodded and shook the judge's hand.
Keith's office at St. Mark's received numerous calls throughout the day. Charlotte Younger fielded them all, explaining that the Reverend was unavailable for comment. Keith finally arrived late in the afternoon. He had been hiding at the hospital all day, visiting the sick, far away from phones and nosy reporters. At his request, Charlotte had kept a log of all callers, and Keith studied it in his office, door locked, phone unplugged. The reporters were from everywhere, from San Diego to Boston, Miami to Portland. 6 of the 39 were from European papers, 11 from Texas. One reporter said he was from Chile, though Charlotte wasn't sure because of the accent. 3 members of St. Mark's had called to complain. They did not like the fact that their pastor was accused of violating the law. Indeed, he seemed to be admitting it. 2 members called to express their admiration and support. The story, though, had not yet made it to the Topeka Morning Paper. That would happen the next day, and Keith expected the same photo to be splashed all over his hometown. Luke, the 6-year-old, had a soccer game under the lights, and since it was Tuesday, the Schroeder family ate at their favorite pizza place. The boys were in bed by 9:30, Keith and Dana by 10. They debated whether to keep the phone silent, but in the end agreed to remove the Do Not Disturb hold and hope for the best. If one reporter called, they would silence the phones. At 11:12, the phone rang. Keith, still awake, grabbed it and said,
Hello.
Pastor, how are we?
It was Travis Boyette. In anticipation of this unlikely event, Keith had rigged a small recorder to his phone. He pushed record and said,
Hello, Travis, and Dana came to life.
She scrambled out of bed, flipped on a light switch, grabbed her cell phone and began punching the number of a Detective Lang, a man they had met with twice.
What are you doing these days? Keith asked.
Just a couple of old friends. Lang had told him to keep Boyette on the line as long as possible.
Moving around. Can't stay in one place too long.
His tongue was thick. His words slow. Still in Missouri?
No, I left Missouri before you did, Pastor. I'm here and there.
You forgot your cane, Travis. Left it on the bed. Why did you do that?
Don't need it. Never did. I exaggerated a little, Pastor. Please forgive me. I got a tumor, but it's been with me for a long time. Meningioma, not a glioblastoma. Grade 1. Benign little fella. It acts up every now and then, but I doubt if it will kill me. The cane was a weapon, Pastor, something I used for self-defense. You live with a bunch of thugs in a halfway house, and you just never know when you might need a weapon.
Country music was in the background. He was probably in a seedy lounge. But you had a limp.
Well, come on, Pastor. If you're using cane, you need a little limp, don't you think?
I wouldn't know, Travis.
You got some folks looking for you. The story of my life. They'll never find me, just like they never found Nicole.
Have they buried her yet, Pastor?
No. Her funeral is Thursday. Dante's is tomorrow.
I might sneak around and watch Nicole's. What do you think about that, Pastor?
Great idea. They would not only catch him, but probably beat him. I think you should, Travis. You're the reason for the funeral. Seems fitting.
How's that cute little wife of yours, Pastor? Bet you guys are having fun. She's so fine.
Knock it off, Travis. Keep him on the line. You thought much about Dante Drum?
Not really. We should have known those people down there wouldn't listen to us.
They would have, Travis, if you'd come forward earlier. If we had found the body first, the execution would not have happened.
Still blaming me, huh?
Who else, Travis? I guess you're still the victim, right?
I don't know what I am. Tell you what, though, Pastor. I gotta find a woman, know what I mean?
Listen to me, Travis. Tell me where you are, and I'll come get you and bring you back to Topeka. I'll leave right now. We'll do another road trip, just the two of us. I don't care where you are. You'll be locked up here, and then they'll extradite you to Missouri. Do what's right for once, Travis, and nobody else will get hurt. Let's do it, pal.
Don't like prison, Pastor. I've seen enough to know.
But you're tired of hurting people, Travis. I know you are. You told me so.
Eh, I guess. I gotta go, Pastor.
Call me anytime, Travis. I'm not tracing these calls. I just want to talk to you. The phone line was dead. An hour later, Detective Lang was at the house, listening to the recording. They'd been able to trace the call to the owner of a stolen cell phone in Lincoln, Nebraska. Chapter 40. The memorial service for Dante Drum was to be held in the sanctuary of the Bethel African Methodist Church, regular capacity of 250. But if folding chairs were wedged into every possible crevice, and the choir loft was packed, and the elders and young men stood too deep along the walls, the capacity might reach